It's her. It's Susan. I can't say anything right now. I hope they get the person or persons who did it before it happens again. It's all this violence. He motions feebly at the television camera. Then the man and woman get into an old car and drive away into the late afternoon traffic. The announcer goes on to say that the girl, Susan Miller, had gotten off work as a cashier in a movie theater in Summit, a town 120 miles north of our town. A green late model car pulled up in front of the theater, and the girl, who, according to witnesses, looked as if she'd been waiting, went over to the car and got in, leading authorities to suspect that the driver of the car was a friend, or at least an acquaintance. The authorities would like to talk to the driver of the green car. Stewart clears his throat, then leans back in the chair and sips his drink. The third thing that happens is that after the news, Stewart stretches, yawns, and looks at me. I get up and begin making a bed for myself on the couch.
What are you doing?
He says, puzzled. I'm not sleepy, I say, avoiding his eyes. I think I'll stay up a while longer and then read something until I fall asleep. He stares as I spread a sheet over the couch. When I start to go for a pillow, he stands at the bedroom door, blocking the way.
I'm going to ask you once more, he says. What the hell do you think you're going to accomplish?
I need to be by myself tonight, I say. I just need to have time to think. He lets out breath.
I'm thinking you're making a big mistake by doing this. I'm thinking you'd better think again about what you're doing. Claire?
I can't answer. I don't know what I want to say. I turn and begin to tuck in the edges of the blanket. He stares at me a minute longer, and then I see him raise his shoulders.
Suit yourself, then. I could give a fuck less what you do.
He says, and turns and walks down the hall, scratching his neck. This morning I read in the paper that services for Susan Miller are to be held in Chapel of the Pines, Summit, at 2 o'clock the next afternoon. Also, that police have taken statements from three people who saw her get into the green Chevrolet, but they still have no license number for the car. They are getting warmer, though. The investigation is continuing. I sit for a long while holding the paper, thinking. Then I call to make an appointment at the hairdresser's. I sit under the dryer with a magazine on my lap and let Millie do my nails. I'm going to a funeral tomorrow, I say after we have talked a bit about a girl who no longer works there. Millie looks up at me and then back at my fingers.
I'm sorry to hear that, Mrs. Kane. I'm real sorry.
It's a young girl's funeral, I say. That's the worst kind. My sister died when I was a girl, and I'm still not over it to this day.
Who died?
She says after a minute. A girl. We weren't all that close, you know, but still.
Too bad. I'm real sorry. But we'll get you fixed up for it, don't worry. How's that look?
That looks fine. Millie, did you ever wish you were somebody else? Or else just nobody, nothing, nothing at all? She looks at me.
I can't say I ever felt that, no. No, if I was somebody else, I'd be afraid I might not like who I was.
She holds my fingers and seems to think about something for a minute.
I don't know. I just don't know.
Let me have your other hand now, Mrs. Kane. At 11 o'clock that night, I make another bed on the couch, and this time Stewart only looks at me, rolls his tongue behind his lips, and goes down the hall to the bedroom. In the night, I wake and listen to the wind slamming the gate against the fence. I don't want to be awake, and I lie for a long while with my eyes closed. Finally, I get up and go down the hall with my pillow. The light is burning in our bedroom, and Stewart is on his back with his mouth open, breathing heavily. I go into Dean's room and get into bed with him. In his sleep, he moves over to give me space. I lie there for a minute and then hold him, my face against his hair.
What is it, Mama?
He says. Nothing, honey. Go back to sleep. It's nothing. It's all right. I get up when I hear Stewart's alarm, put on coffee, and prepare breakfast while he shaves.
He appears in the kitchen doorway, towel over his bare shoulder, appraising. "Here's coffee," I say. "Eggs will be ready in a minute." He nods. I wake Dean and the three of us have breakfast. Once or twice, Stuart looks at me as if he wants to say something, but each time I ask Dean if he wants more milk, more toast, etc.
"I'll call you today," Stuart says as he opens the door.
"I don't think I'll be home today," I say quickly. "I have a lot of things to do today. In fact, I may be late for dinner."
"All right. Sure."
He wants to know. He moves his briefcase from one hand to the other.
"Maybe we'll go out for dinner tonight? How would you like that?"
He keeps looking at me. He's forgotten about the girl already.
"Are you all right?"
I move to straighten his tie, then drop my hand. He wants to kiss me goodbye. I move back a step.
"Have a nice day, then," he says finally.
Then he turns and goes down the walk to his car. I dress carefully. I try on a hat that I haven't worn in several years and look at myself in the mirror. Then I remove the hat, apply a light makeup, and write a note for Dean. "Honey, Mommy has things to do this afternoon, but will be home later. You are to stay in the house or in the backyard until one of us comes home. Love." I look at the word love and then I underline it. As I am writing the note, I realize I don't know whether backyard is one word or two. I have never considered it before. I think about it, and then I draw a line and make two words of it. I stop for gas and ask directions to Summit. Barry, a 40-year-old mechanic with a mustache, comes out from the restroom and leans against the front fender while the other man, Lewis, puts the hose into the tank and begins to slowly wash the windshields.
"Summit," Barry says, looking at me and smoothing a finger down each side of his mustache. "There's no best way to get to Summit, Mrs. Kane. It's about a 2-2.5 hour drive each way, across the mountains. It's quite a drive for a woman." "Summit? What's in Summit, Mrs. Kane?"
"I have business," I say, vaguely uneasy. Lewis has gone to wait on another car.
"Ah. Well, if I wasn't all tied up there."
He gestures with his thumb toward the bay.
"I'd offer to drive you to Summit and back again. Road's not all that good. I mean, it's good enough. There's just a lot of curves and so on."
"I'll be all right, but thank you." He leans against the fender. I can feel his eyes as I open my purse. Barry takes the credit card.
"Don't drive it at night," he says. "It's not all that good a road, like I said, and while I'd be willing to bet you wouldn't have car trouble with this, I know this car. You can never be sure about blowouts and things like that. Just to be on the safe side, I'd better check these tires."
He taps one of the front tires with his shoe.
"We'll run it onto the hoist. Won't take long."
"No, no, it's all right. Really, I can't take any more time. The tires look fine to me."
"Only takes a minute," he says. "Be on the safe side."
I said no, no. They look fine to me. I have to go now, Barry.
"Mrs. Kane?"
"I have to go now." I sign something. He gives me the receipt, the card, some stamps. I put everything in my purse.
"You take it easy," he says. "Be seeing you."
Waiting to pull into traffic, I look back and see him watching. I close my eyes, then open them. He waves. I turn at the first light. Then turn again and drive until I come to the highway and read the sign. Summit, 117 miles. It is 10:30 and warm. The highway skirts the edge of town, then passes through farm country, through fields of oats and sugar beets and apple orchards, with here and there a small herd of cattle grazing in open pastures. Then everything changes. The farms become fewer and fewer, more like shacks now than houses, and stands of timber replace the orchards. All at once I'm in the mountains, and on the right, far below, I catch glimpses of the Natchez River. In a little while, a green pickup truck comes up behind me and stays behind for miles. I keep slowing at the wrong times, hoping he will pass, and then increasing my speed, again at the wrong times. I grip the wheel until my fingers hurt. Then on a long, clear stretch he does pass, but he drives along beside for a minute, a crew-cut man in a blue work shirt in his early 30s, and we look at each other. Then he waves, toots the horn twice, and pulls ahead of me. I slow down and find a place, a dirt road off the shoulder, pull over and shut off the ignition. I can hear the river somewhere down below the trees. Ahead of me, the dirt road goes into the trees. Then I hear the pickup returning. I start the engine just as the truck pulls up behind me. I lock the doors and roll up the windows. Perspiration breaks on my face and arms as I put the car in gear, but there is no place to drive. "You all right?" the man says as he comes up to the car. "Hello? Hello in there?" He raps the glass. "Are you okay?" He leans his arms on the door and then brings his face close to the window. I stare at him and can't find any words. "After I passed, I slowed up some," he says. "But when I didn't see you in the mirror, I pulled off and waited a couple of minutes. When you still didn't show, I thought I'd better drive back and check. Is everything all right? How come you're locked up in there?" I shake my head. "Come on, roll down your window. Hey, are you sure you're okay, huh? You know it's not good for a woman to be batting around the country by herself." He shakes his head and looks at the highway and then back at me. "Now come on, roll down the window. How about it? We can't talk this way." "Please, I have to go." "Open the door, all right," he says, as if he isn't listening. "At least roll down the window. You're going to smother in there." He looks at my breasts and legs. The skirt has pulled up over my knees. His eyes linger on my legs, but I sit still, afraid to move. "I want to smother," I say. "I am smothering, can't you see?" "What in the hell?" he says and moves back from the door. He turns and walks back to his truck. Then, in the side mirror, I watch him returning and close my eyes. "You don't want me to follow you towards Summit or anything?" "I don't mind. I got some extra time this morning." I shake my head again. He hesitates and then shrugs. "Have it your way, then," he says. I wait until he has reached the highway and then I back out. He shifts gears and pulls away slowly, looking back at me in his rearview mirror. I stop the car on the shoulder and put my head on the wheel. The casket is closed and covered with floral sprays. The organ begins soon after I take a seat near the back of the chapel. People begin to file in and find chairs, some middle-aged and older people, but most of them in their early 20s or even younger. They are people who look uncomfortable in their suits and ties, sports coats and slacks, their dark dresses and leather gloves. One boy in flared pants and a yellow short-sleeved shirt takes the chair next to mine and begins to bite his lips. A door opens at one side of the chapel and I look up, and for a minute the parking lot reminds me of a meadow, but then the sun flashes on car windows. The family enters in a group and moves into a curtained area off to the side. Chairs creak as they settle themselves. In a few minutes, a thick blonde man in a dark suit stands and asks us to bow our heads. He speaks a brief prayer for us, the living, and when he finishes, he asks us to pray in silence for the soul of Susan Miller, departed. I close my eyes and remember her picture in the newspaper and on television. I see her leaving the theater and getting into the green Chevrolet. Then I imagine her journey down the river, the nude body hitting rocks, caught at by branches, the body floating and turning, her hair streaming in the water. Then the hands and hair catching in the overhanging branches, holding until four men come along to stare at her. I can see a man who is drunk. Stuart? Take her by the wrist. Does anyone here know about that? What if these people knew that? I look around at the other faces. There is a connection to be made of these things, these events, these faces, if I can find it. My head aches with the effort to find it. He talks about Susan Miller's gifts, cheerfulness and beauty, grace and enthusiasm. From behind the closed curtain, someone clears his throat. Someone else sobs. The organ music begins. The service is over. Along with the others, I file slowly past the casket. Then I move out onto the front steps and into the bright, hot afternoon light. A middle-aged woman who limps as she goes down the stairs ahead of me reaches the sidewalk and looks around, her eyes falling on me. "Well, they got him," she says. if that's any consolation. They arrested him this morning. I heard it on the radio before I came. A guy right here in town. A long hair, you might have guessed. We move a few steps down the hot sidewalk. People are starting cars. I put out my hand and hold on to a parking meter. Sunlight glances off polished hoods and fenders. My head swims. He's admitted having relations with her that night, but he says he didn't kill her. She snorts. You know as well as I do. But they'll probably put him on probation and then turn him loose. He might not have acted alone, I say. They'll have to be sure. He might be covering up for someone, a brother or some friends. I have known that child since she was a little girl. The woman goes on and her lips tremble. She used to come over and I'd bake cookies for her and let her eat them in front of the TV. She looks off and begins shaking her head as the tears roll down her cheeks. 3. Stuart sits at the table with a drink in front of him. His eyes are red, and for a minute I think he has been crying. He looks at me and doesn't say anything. For a wild instant, I feel something has happened to Dean, and my heart turns. Where is he, I say. Where is Dean? Outside, he says. Stuart, I'm so afraid. So afraid, I say, leaning against the door. What are you afraid of, Claire? Tell me, honey, and maybe I can help. I'd like to help. Just try me. That's what husbands are for. I can't explain, I say. I'm just afraid. I feel like... He drains his glass and stands up, not taking his eyes from me. I think I know what you need, honey. Let me play doctor, okay? Just take it easy now. He reaches an arm around my waist and with his other hand begins to unbutton my jacket, then my blouse. First things first, he says, trying to joke. Not now, please, I say. Not now, please, he says, teasing. Please, nothing. Then he steps behind me and locks an arm around my waist. One of his hands slips under my brassiere. Stop, 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 I say. I stamp on his toes. And then I am lifted up and then falling. I sit on the floor looking up at him and my neck hurts and my skirt is over my knees. He leans down and says, you go to hell then, do you hear, bitch? I hope your cunt drops off before I touch it again. He sobs once and I realize he can't help it. He can't help himself either. I feel a rush of pity for him as he heads for the living room. He didn't sleep at home last night. This morning, flowers, red and yellow chrysanthemums. I am drinking coffee when the doorbell rings. Mrs. Kane, the young man says, holding his box of flowers. I nod and pull the robe tighter at my throat. The man who called, he said you'd know. The boy looks at my robe, open at the throat, and touches his cap. He stands with his legs apart, feet firmly planted on the top step as if asking me to touch him down there. Have a nice day, he says. A little later, the telephone rings and Stuart says, honey, how are you? I'll be home early. I love you. Did you hear me? I love you. I'm sorry. I'll make it up to you. Goodbye. I have to run now. I put the flowers into a vase in the center of the dining room table and then I move my things into the extra bedroom. Last night, around midnight, Stuart breaks the lock on my door. He does it just to show me that he can, I suppose, for he does not do anything when the door springs open except stand there in his underwear looking surprised and foolish while the anger slips from his face. He shuts the door slowly, and a few minutes later I hear him in the kitchen opening a tray of ice cubes. He calls today to tell me that he's asked his mother to come stay with us for a few days. I wait a minute thinking about this, and then I hang up while he is still talking. But in a while I dial his number at work. When he finally comes on the line, I say, it doesn't matter, Stuart. Really, I tell you, it doesn't matter one way or the other. I love you, he says. He says something else, and I listen and nod slowly. I feel sleepy. Then I wake up and say, for God's sake, Stuart, she was only a child.
Dummy. My father was very nervous and disagreeable for a long time after Dummy's death. And I believe it somehow marked the end of a halcyon period in his life, too, for it wasn't much later that his own health began to fail. First Dummy, then Pearl Harbor, then the move to my grandfather's farm near Wenatchee, where my father finished out his days caring for a dozen apple trees and 5 head of cattle. For me, Dummy's death signaled the end of my extraordinarily long childhood, sending me forth, ready or not, into the world of men.
where defeat and death are more in the natural order of things. First, my father blamed it on the woman, Dummy's wife. Then he said no, it was the fish. If it hadn't been for the fish, it wouldn't have happened. I know he felt some to blame for it, because it was Father showed Dummy the advertisement in the classified section of Field and Stream for live black bass shipped anywhere in the U.S. It may be there now, for all I know. I was at work one afternoon, and Father asked Dummy why not order some bass and stock that pond in back of his house. Dummy wet his lips, Father said, and studied the advertisement a long while before laboriously copying the information down on the back of a candy wrapper and stuffing the wrapper down the front of his coveralls. It was later, after he received the fish, he began acting peculiarly. It changed his whole personality, Father claimed. I never knew his real name. If anyone else did, I never heard it called. Dummy it was then, and Dummy I remember him by now. He was a little wrinkled man in his late 50s, bald-headed, short but very muscular arms and legs. If he grinned, which was seldom, his lips furled back over yellow broken teeth and gave him an unpleasant, almost crafty expression, an expression I still remember very clearly, though it's been 25 years ago. His small, watery eyes always watched your lips when you were speaking, though sometimes they'd roam familiarly over your face or your body. I don't know why, but I had the impression he was never really deaf, at least not as deaf as he made out. But that isn't important. He couldn't speak, that was certain enough. He worked at the sawmill where my father worked, the Cascade Lumber Company in Yakima, Washington, and it was the men there who had given him the nickname Dummy. He had worked there ever since the early 1920s. He was working as a cleanup man when I knew him, though I guess at one time or another he'd done every kind of common labor job around the plant. He wore a grease-spotted felt hat, a khaki work shirt, and a light denim jacket over a bulging pair of coveralls. In his top front pockets, he nearly always carried two or three rolls of toilet paper, as one of his jobs was to clean and supply the men's toilets. And the men on nights used to walk off after their shift with a roll or two in their lunch boxes. He also carried a flashlight, even though he worked days, as well as wrenches, pliers, screwdrivers, friction tape, all the things the millwrights carried. Some of the newer men, like Ted Slade or Johnny Waite, might kid him pretty heavily in the lunchroom about something, or tell him dirty jokes to see what he'd do, just because they knew he didn't like dirty jokes. Or Carl Lowe, the sawyer, might reach down and snag Dummy's hat as he walked onto the platform, but Dummy seemed to take it all in stride, as if he expected to be kidded and had gotten used to it. Once, though, one day when I took Father his lunch at noon, four or five of the men had Dummy off in a corner at one of the tables. One of the men was drawing a picture and, grinning, was trying to explain something to Dummy, touching here and there on the paper with his pencil. Dummy was frowning. His neck crimsoned as I watched, and he suddenly drew back and hit the table with his fist. After a moment's stunned silence, everyone at the table broke up with laughter. My father didn't approve of the kidding. He never kidded Dummy, to my knowledge. Father was a big, heavy-shouldered man with a crew haircut, a double chin, and a paunch, which, given the chance, he was fond of showing off. He was easy to make laugh, just as easy, only in a different way, to get riled. Dummy would stop in the filing room where he worked and sit on a stool and watch Father use the big emery wheel grinders on the saws, and if he wasn't too busy, he'd talk to Dummy as he worked. Dummy seemed to like my father. And Father liked him too, I'm certain. In his own way, Father was probably as good a friend as Dummy had. Dummy lived in a small, tar-paper-covered house near the river, 5 or 6 miles from town. A half a mile behind the house, at the end of a pasture, lay a big gravel pit that the state had dug years before when they were paving the roads in that area. Three good-sized holes had been scooped out, and over the years they had filled with water. Eventually, the three separate ponds had formed one really large pond, with a towering pile of rocks at one side and two smaller piles on the other. The water was deep, with a blackish-green look to it, clear enough at the surface, but murky down toward the bottom. Dummy was married to a woman 15 or 20 years younger than he, who had the reputation of going around with Mexicans.
Father said later it was busybodies at the mill that helped get Dummy so worked up at the end by telling him things about his wife. She was a small, stout woman with glittery, suspicious eyes. I'd only seen her twice. Once when she came to the window the time Father and I arrived at Dummy's to go fishing, and one other time when Pete Jensen and I stopped there on our bicycles to get a glass of water. It wasn't just the way she made us wait out on the porch in the hot sun without asking us in that made her seem so distant and unfriendly. It was partly the way she said, "What do you want?" when she opened the door, before we could say a word. Partly the way she scowled, and partly the house, I suppose. The dry, musty smell that came through the open door and reminded me of my Aunt Mary's cellar. She was a lot different than other grown women I'd met. I just stared for a minute before I could say anything.
"I'm Del Frazier's son. He works with your husband. We were just on our bicycles and thought we'd stop for a drink."
"Just a minute," she said. "Wait here."
Pete and I looked at each other. She returned with a little tin cup of water in each hand. I downed mine in a single gulp and then ran my tongue around the cool rim. She didn't offer us any more. I said, "Thanks," handing back the cup and smacking my lips.
"Thanks a lot,"
Pete said. She watched us without saying anything. Then as we started to get on our bicycles, she walked over to the edge of the porch.
"You little fellows had a car now, I might catch a ride into town with you."
She grinned. Her teeth looked shiny white and too large for her mouth from where I stood. It was worse than seeing her scowl. I turned the handle grips back and forth and stared at her uneasily.
"Let's go," Pete said to me. "Maybe Jerry'll give us a pop if his dad ain't there."
He started away on his bicycle and looked back a few seconds later at the woman standing on the porch, still grinning to herself at her little joke.
"I wouldn't take you to town if I had a car,"
he called. I pushed off hurriedly and followed him down the road without looking back. There weren't many places you could fish for bass in our part of Washington. Rainbow trout, mostly. A few brook trout and Dolly Varden in some of the high mountain streams, and silvers in Blue Lake and Lake Rimrock. That was mostly it, except for the migratory runs of steelhead and salmon in several of the freshwater rivers in the late fall. But if you were a fisherman, it was enough to keep you occupied. No one I knew fished for bass. A lot of people I knew had never seen a real bass, only pictures now and then in some of the outdoor magazines. But my father had seen plenty of bass when he was growing up in Arkansas and Georgia. Back home, as he always referred to the South. Now, though, he just liked to fish and didn't care much what he caught. I don't think he minded if he caught anything. I believe he just liked the idea of staying out all day, eating sandwiches and drinking beer with friends while sitting in a boat, or else walking by himself up or down a riverbank and having time to think, if that's what he felt like doing that particular day. Trout, then, all kinds of trout, salmon and steelhead in the fall, and whitefish in the winter on the Columbia River. Father would fish for anything, at any time of the year, and with pleasure. But I think he was especially pleased that Dummy was going to stock his pond with black bass, for of course Father assumed that when the bass were large enough, he'd be able to fish there as often as he wished, Dummy being a friend. His eyes gleamed when he told me one evening that Dummy had sent off in the mail for a supply of black bass.
"Our own private pond," Father said. "Wait till you tie into a bass, Jack. You'll be all done as a trout fisherman."
3 or 4 weeks later, the fish arrived. I'd gone swimming at the city pool that afternoon, and Father told me about it later. He'd just gotten home from work and changed clothes when Dummy pulled up in the driveway. With hands trembling, he showed Father the wire from the parcel post he'd found at home that said 3 tanks of live fish from Baton Rouge, Louisiana were waiting to be picked up. Father was excited, too, and he and Dummy went down right then in Dummy's pickup. The tanks, barrels really, were each crated in white, clean-smelling new pine boards, with large rectangular openings cut on the sides and at the top of each crate. They were standing in the shade around at the back of the train depot, and it took my father and Dummy both to lift each crate into the back of the truck. Dummy drove very carefully through town and then 25 miles an hour all the way to his house. He drove through his yard without stopping, down to within 50 feet of the pond. By that time it was nearly dark and he had his headlights on. He had a hammer and a tire iron under the seat and jumped out with them in his hand as soon as they stopped. They lugged all three tanks down close to the water before Dummy started to open the first crate. He worked in the headlights from his truck and once caught his thumb with the claw side of the hammer. The blood oozed thickly out over the white boards, but he didn't seem to notice. After he'd pried the boards off the first tank, he found the barrel inside covered thickly with burlap and a kind of rattan material. A heavy board lid had a dozen nickel-sized holes scattered around. They raised the lid, and both of them moved up over the tank as Dummy took out his flashlight. Inside, scores of little bass fingerlings finned darkly in the water in the tank. The beam of light didn't bother them. They just swam and circled darkly without seeming to go anywhere. Dummy moved his light around the tank several minutes before he snapped it off and dropped it back in his pocket. He picked up the barrel with a grunt, started down to the water. "Wait a minute, Dummy, let me help you," Father called to him. Dummy set the tank at the water's edge, again removed the lid, and slowly poured the contents into the pond. He took out his flashlight and shined it into the water. Father went down, but there was nothing to be seen. The fish had scattered. Frogs croaked hoarsely on all sides, and in the overhead dark, nighthawks wheeled and darted after insects. "Let me get the other crate, Dummy," Father said, reaching as if to take the hammer from Dummy's coveralls. Dummy pulled back and shook his head. He undid the two crates himself, leaving dark drops of blood on the boards, stopping long enough with each tank to shine his light through the clear water to where the little bass swam slowly and darkly from one side to the other. Dummy breathed heavily through his open mouth the whole time, and when he was through, he gathered up all the boards and the burlap mesh and the barrels and threw everything noisily into the back of the truck. From that night, Father maintained, Dummy was a different person. The change didn't come about all at once, of course. But after that night, gradually, ever gradually, Dummy moved closer to the abyss. His thumb was swollen and still bleeding some, and his eyes had a protruding glassy look to them in the light from the dashboard as he bounced the truck across the pasture and then drove the road taking Father home. That was the summer I was 12. Dummy wouldn't let anyone go there now, not after Father and I tried to fish there one afternoon 2 years later. In those 2 years, Dummy had fenced all the pasture behind his house, and then fenced the pond itself with electrically charged barbed wire. It cost him over $500 for materials alone, Father said to my mother in disgust. Father wouldn't have any more to do with Dummy, not since that afternoon we were out there toward the end of July. Father had even stopped speaking to Dummy, and he wasn't the sort to cut anyone. One evening, just before fall, when Father was working late and I took him his dinner, a plate of hot food covered with aluminum foil and a mason jar of iced tea, I found him standing in front of the window talking with Sid Glover, the millwright. Father gave a short, unnaturally harsh laugh just as I came in and said, "You'd guess that fool was married to them fish the way he acts. I just wonder when the men in white coats will come to take him away." "From what I hear," Sid said, "he'd do better to put that fence round his house, or his bedroom, to be more exact." Father looked around and saw me, then raised his eyebrows slightly. He looked back at Sid. "But I told you how he acted, didn't I? The time he and Jack was out to his house." Sid nodded, and Father rubbed his chin reflectively, then spat out the open window into the sawdust, before turning to me with a greeting. A month before, Father had finally prevailed upon Dummy to let the two of us fish the pond. Bulldozed him might be the better word, for Father said he decided he simply wasn't going to take any more excuses. He said he could see Dummy stiffen up when he kept insisting one day, but he went on talking fast, joking to Dummy about thinning out the weakest bass, doing the rest of the bass a favor, and so on. Dummy just stood there, pulling at his ear and staring at the floor. Father finally said we'd see him tomorrow afternoon then, right after work. Dummy turned and walked away. I was excited. Father had told me before that the fish had multiplied crazily and it would be like dropping your line into a hatchery pond. We sat at the kitchen table that night long after Mother had gone to bed, talking and eating snacks and listening to the radio. Next afternoon, when Father pulled into the drive, I was waiting on the front lawn. I had his half-dozen old bass plugs out of their boxes, testing the sharpness of the treble hooks with my forefinger. "You ready?" he called to me, jumping out of the car. "I'll go to the toilet in a hurry. You put the stuff in. You can drive us out there if you want."
"You bet," I said.
Things were starting out great. I put everything in the back seat and started toward the house when Father came out the front door wearing his canvas fishing hat and eating a piece of chocolate cake with both hands.
Get in," he said between bites. "You ready?"
I got in on the driver's side while he went around the car. Mother looked at us. A fair-skinned, severe woman, her blonde hair pulled into a bun at the back of her head and fastened down with a rhinestone clip. Father waved to her. I let off the handbrake and backed out slowly onto the road. She watched us until I shifted gears and then waved, still unsmiling. I waved and Father waved again. He'd finished his cake and he wiped his hands on his pants.
"We're off," he said.
It was a fine afternoon. We had all the windows down in the 1940 Ford station wagon, and the air was cold and blew through the car. The telephone wires alongside the road made a humming noise, and after we crossed the Moxie Bridge and swung west onto Slater Road, a big rooster pheasant and two hens flew low across the road in front of us and pitched into an alfalfa field.
"Look at that," Father said. "We'll have to come out here this fall. Harlan Winters has bought a place out here somewheres, I don't know exactly where, but he said he'd let us hunt when the season opens."
On either side of us, green wavy alfalfa fields, with now and then a house or a house with a barn and some livestock behind a rail fence. Farther on, to the west, a huge yellow-brown cornfield, and behind that, a stand of white birch trees that grew beside the river. A few white clouds moved across the sky.
"It's really great, isn't it, Dad? I mean, I don't know, but everything's just fun we do, isn't it?"
Father sat in the seat cross-legged, tapping his toe against the floorboards. He put his arm out the window and let the wind take it.
"Sure it is. Everything."
Then, after a minute, he said, "Sure, you bet it's fun. Great to be alive." In a few minutes, we pulled up in front of Dummies, and he came out of the house wearing his hat. His wife looked out the window.
"You have your frying pan out, Dummy,"
Father called to him as he came down the porch steps.
"Filet of bass and fried potatoes."
Dummy came up to where we stood beside the car.
"What a day for it," Father went on. "Where's your pole, Dummy? Ain't you going to fish?"
Dummy jerked his head back and forth. "No." He moved his weight from one bandy leg to the other, and he looked at the ground and then at us. His tongue rested on his lower lip, and he began working his right foot into the dirt. I shouldered the wicker creel and immediately felt Dummy's eyes on me, watching as I gave Father his pole and picked up my own.
"We ready?" Father said. "Dummy?"
Dummy took off his hat and with the same hand wiped his wrist over his bald head. He turned abruptly and we followed him over to the fence, about 100 feet behind his house. Father winked at me. We walked slowly across the spongy pasture. There was a fresh, clean smell in the air. Every 20 feet or so, a snipe flew up from the clumps of grass at the edge of the old furrows, and once a hen mallard jumped off a tiny, almost invisible puddle of water and flew off, quacking loudly.
"Probably got her nest there," Father said.
A few feet farther on, he began whistling, but then stopped after a minute. At the end of the pasture, the ground sloped gently and became dry and rocky with a few nettle bushes and scrub oak trees scattered here and there. Ahead of us, behind a tall stand of willows, the first pile of rocks rose 50 or 75 feet in the air. We cut to the right, following an old set of car tracks, going through a field of milkweed that came up to our waists. The dry pods at the tops of the stalks rattled as we pushed through. Dummy was walking ahead, I followed two or three steps behind, and Father was behind me. I suddenly saw the sheen of water over Dummy's shoulder, and my heart jumped. "There it is," I blurted out. "There it is," Father said after me, craning his neck to see. Dummy began walking even slower and kept bringing his hand up nervously and moving his hat back and forth over his head. He stopped. Father came up beside him and said, "What do you think, Dummy? Is one place as good as another? Where should we come onto it?" Dummy wet his lower lip and looked around at us as if frightened. "What's the matter with you, Dummy?" Father said sharply. "This is your pond, ain't it? You act like we was trespassing or something." Dummy looked down and picked an ant off the front of his coveralls. "Well, hell," Father said, letting out his breath. He took out his watch. "If it's still all right with you, Dummy, we can fish for 45 minutes or an hour before it gets dark. Huh? What about it?" Dummy looked at him and then put his hands in his front pockets and turned toward the pond. He started walking again. Father looked at me and shrugged. We trailed along behind. Dummy, acting the way he was, took some of the edge off our excitement. Father spat two or three times without clearing his throat. We could see the whole pond now, and the water was dimpled with rising fish. Every minute or so, a bass would leap clear of the water and come down hugely in a great splash, sending the water across the pond in ever-widening circles. As we came closer, we could hear the kersplat splat as they hit the water. "My God," Father said under his breath. We came up to the pond at an open place, a gravel beach 50 feet long. Some shoulder-high water tools grew on the left, but the water was clear and open in front of us. The three of us stood there side by side a minute, watching the fish come up out toward the center. "Get down," Father said as he dropped into an awkward crouch. I dropped down too, and peered into the water in front of us where he was staring. "Honest to God," he whispered. A school of bass cruised slowly by, 20 or 30 of them, not one under 2 pounds. The fish veered off slowly. Dummy was still standing, watching them. But a few minutes later, the same school returned, swimming thickly under the dark water, almost touching one another. I could see their big, heavy-lidded eyes watching us as they finned slowly by, their shiny sides rippling under the water. They turned again for the third time and then went on, followed by two or three stragglers. It didn't make any difference if we sat down or stood up. The fish just weren't frightened of us. Father said later he felt sure Dummy came down there afternoons and fed them because instead of shying away from us as fish should do, these turned in even closer to the bank. "It was a sight to behold," he said afterwards. We sat there for 10 minutes, Father and I, watching the bass come swimming up out of the deep water and fin idly by in front of us. Dummy just stood there, pulling at his fingers and looking around the pond as if he expected someone. I could look straight down the pond to where the tallest rock pile shelved into the water, the deepest part, Father said. I let my eyes roam around the perimeter of the pond, the grove of willows, the birch trees, the great tule bed at the far end, a block away where the blackbirds flew in and out, calling in their high, warbling summer voices. The sun was behind our backs now, pleasantly warm on my neck. There was no wind. All over the pond, the bass were coming up to nuzzle the water, or jumping clear of the water and falling on their sides, or coming up to the surface to cruise with their dorsal fins sticking out of the water like black hand fans. We finally got up to cast, and I was shaky with excitement. I could hardly take the plug hooks from the cork handle of the rod. Dummy suddenly gripped my shoulder with his big fingers, and I found his pinched face a few inches from mine. He bobbed his chin two or three times at my father. He wanted only one of us to cast, and that was Father.
"Shh, Jesus," Father said, looking at us both. "Jesus K. Christ."
He laid his pole on the gravel after a minute. He took off his hat and then put it back on and glared at Dummy before he moved over to where I stood. "Go ahead, Jack," he said. "That's all right. Go ahead, son." I looked at Dummy just before I cast. His face had gone rigid, and there was a thin line of drool on his chin.
"Come back hard on the son of a bitch when he strikes," Father said. "Make sure you set the hooks. Their mouths are as hard as a doorknob."
I flipped off the drag lever and threw back my arm, lurched forward and heaved the rattling yellow plug out as far as I could. It splatted the water 40 feet away. Before I could begin winding to pick up the slack, the water boiled.
"Hit him," Father yelled. "You got him, hit him, hit him again."
I came back hard twice. I had him all right. The steel casting rod bowed over and sprung wildly back and forth. Father kept yelling,
"Let him go, let him go, let him run with it. Give him more line, Jack. Now wind in, wind in. No, let him run. Woo-wee, look at him go."
The bass jumped around the pond, and every time it came up out of the water, it shook its head, and we could hear the plug rattle. And then the bass would take off in another run. In 10 minutes, I had the fish on its side a few feet from shore. It looked enormous, 6 or 7 pounds maybe, and it lay on its side, whipped, mouth open and gills working slowly. My knees felt so weak I could hardly stand, but I held the rod up, the line tight. Father waded out over his shoes. Dummy began sputtering behind me, but I was afraid to take my eyes away from the fish. Father kept moving closer, leaning forward now, his arm reaching lower, trying to gill it. Dummy suddenly stepped in front of me and began shaking his head and waving his hands. Father glanced at him.
"Why, what the hell's the matter with you, you son of a bitch? This boy's got hold of the biggest bass I've seen. He ain't going to throw it back. What's wrong with you?"
Dummy kept shaking his head and gesturing toward the pond.
"I'm not about to let this boy's fish go. You've got another thing coming if you think I'm going to do that."
Dummy reached for my line. Meanwhile, the bass had gained strength and turned over and started swimming back out again. I yelled, and then I lost my head, I guess. I slammed down the brake on the reel and started winding. The bass made a last furious run, and the plug flew over our heads and caught in a tree branch.
"Come on, Jack," Father said, grabbing up his pole. "Let's get out of here before we're crazy as this son of a bitch. Come on, goddamn him before I knock him down."
We started away from the pond, Father snapping his jaws, he was so angry. We walked fast. I wanted to cry but kept swallowing rapidly, trying to hold back the tears. Once Father stumbled over a rock and ran forward a few feet to keep from falling.
"God damn this son of a bitch," he muttered.
The sun was almost down and a breeze had come up. I looked back over my shoulder and saw Dummy still down at the pond, only now he'd moved over by the willows and had one arm wrapped around a tree, was leaning over and looking down into the water. He looked very dark and tiny beside the water. Father saw me look back and he stopped and turned.
"He's talking to them," he said. "He's telling them he's sorry. He's crazy as a coot, that son of a bitch. Come on."
That February, the river flooded. It had snowed heavily throughout our part of the state during the first weeks of December, and then the weather had turned very cold just before Christmas. The ground froze, and the snow remained fast on the ground. Toward the end of January, the Chinook wind struck. I woke up one morning to hear the house being buffeted by the wind and the steady drizzle of water running off the roof. It blew for 5 days. And on the third day, the river began to rise.
"It's up to 15 feet, Father said one evening, looking up from the newspaper. 3 feet over flood level. Old Dummy's going to lose his fish."
I wanted to go down to the Moxie Bridge to see how high the water was running, but Father shook his head.
"A flood is nothing to see. I've seen all the floods I want to see."
2 days later, the river crested. And after that, the water slowly began to subside. Orrin Marshall and Danny Owens and I bicycled the 5 or 6 miles out to Dummy's one Saturday morning a week later. We parked the bicycles off the road before we got there and walked across pasture land that bordered Dummy's property. It was a damp, blustery day, the clouds dark and broken, moving fast across the gray sky. The ground was soppy wet, and we kept coming to puddles in the thick grass that we couldn't go around, so we waded through. Danny was just learning how to cuss and filled the air with a wild string of profanities every time he stepped in over his shoes. We could see the swollen river at the end of the pasture. the water still high and out of its channel, surging around the trunks of trees and eating away at the edge of the land. Out toward the middle, the water moved heavily and swiftly, and now and then a bush floated by, or a tree with its branches sticking up. We came to Dummy's fence and found a cow wedged in against the wire. She was bloated and her skin was slick-looking and gray. It was the first dead thing of any size any of us had seen. Orin took a stick and touched the open jelly eyes, then raised the tail and touched here and there with the stick. We moved on down the fence toward the river. We were afraid to touch the wire because we thought it might still carry an electric shock. But at the edge of what looked like a deep canal, the fence came to an abrupt end. The ground had simply dropped into the water here, and this part of the fence as well. We crossed through the wire and followed the swift channel that cut directly into Dummy's land and headed straight for his pond. Coming closer, we saw that the channel had cut lengthwise into the pond, forced an outlet for itself at the other end, then twisted and turned several times, and rejoined the river a quarter of a mile away. The pond itself now looked like a part of the main river, broad and turbulent. There was no doubt that most of Dummy's fish had been carried away, and those that might remain would be free to come and go as they pleased when the water dropped. Then I caught sight of Dummy. It scared me, seeing him, and I motioned to the other guys and we all got down. He was standing at the far side of the pond, near where the water rushed out, gazing into the rapids. In a while he looked up and saw us. We broke suddenly and fled the way we'd come, running like frightened rabbits. "I can't help but feel sorry for old Dummy, though," Father said at dinner one night a few weeks later. "Things are going all to hell for him, that's for sure. He brought it on himself, but you can't help feeling sorry for him anyway." Father went on to say George Laycock saw Dummy's wife sitting in the sportsman's club with a big Mexican fellow last Friday night. "And that ain't the half of it." Mother looked up at him sharply and then at me, but I just went on eating like I hadn't heard anything. "Damn it to hell, B, the boy's old enough to know the facts of life. Anyway," he said after a minute to no one in particular, "there's liable to be some trouble there." He'd changed a lot, Dummy had. He was never around any of the men now if he could help it. He didn't take his breaks at the same time, nor did he eat his lunch with them anymore. No one felt like joking with him any longer either, since he chased Carl low with a 2x4 stud after Carl knocked his hat off. He was missing a day or two a week from work on the average, and there was some talk of his being laid off. "He's going off the deep end," Father said. "Clear crazy if you don't watch out." Then on a Sunday afternoon in May, just before my birthday, Father and I were cleaning the garage. It was a warm, still day, and the dust hung in the air in the garage. Mother came to the back door and said, "Dale, there's a call for you. I think it's Vern." I followed him inside to wash up, and I heard him take the phone and say, "Vern, how are you? What? Don't tell me that, Vern. No, God, that ain't true, Vern." "All right. Yes. Goodbye." He put the phone down and turned to us. His face was pale and he put his hand on the table. "Some bad news. It's Dummy. He drowned himself last night and killed his wife with a hammer. Vern just heard it on the radio." We drove out there an hour later. Cars were parked in front of the house and between the house and the pasture. Two or three sheriff's cars, a highway patrol car, and several other cars. The gate to the pasture stood open, and I could see tire marks that led toward the pond. The screen door was propped open with a box, and a thin, pock-faced man in slacks and sports shirt and wearing a shoulder holster stood in the doorway. He watched us get out of the station wagon. "What happened?" Father asked. The man shook his head.
"Have to read about it in the paper tomorrow night."
"Did they find him?"
"Not yet. They're still dragging."
"All right if we walk down? I knew him pretty well."
"Don't matter to me. They might chase you off down there, though."
"You want to stay here, Jack?" Father asked.
"No," I said. "I guess I'll go along."
We walked across the pasture, following the tire marks, taking pretty much the same route as we had the summer before. As we got closer, we could hear the motorboats, could see the dirty fluffs of exhaust smoke hanging over the pond. There was only a small trickle of water coming in and leaving the pond now, though you could see where the high water had cut away the ground and carried off rocks and trees. Two small boats with two uniformed men in each cruised slowly back and forth over the water. One man steered from the front, and the other man sat in the back, handling the rope for the hooks. An ambulance was parked on the gravel beach where we'd fished that evening so long ago, and two men in white lounged against the back, smoking cigarettes. The door was open on the sheriff's car, parked a few feet the other side of the ambulance, and I could hear a loud, crackling voice coming over the speaker. "What happened?" Father asked the deputy, who was standing near the water, hands on hips, watching one of the boats. "I knew him pretty well," he added. "We worked together."
"Murder and suicide, it appears," the man said, taking an unlit cigar from his mouth.
He looked us over and then looked back at the boat again.
"How'd it happen?" Father persisted.
The deputy hooked his fingers under his belt, shifted the large revolver a little more comfortably on his broad hip. He spoke from the side of his mouth around his cigar.
"He took the wife out of a bar last night and beat her to death in the truck with a hammer. There was witnesses. Then, whatever his name is, he drove to this here pond with the woman in the truck still and just jumped in over his head. Beats all. I don't know, couldn't swim, I guess, but I don't know that. But they say it's hard for a man to drown himself, just give up and drown without even trying, if he knows how to swim. A fellow named Garcia followed them home. Had been chasing after the woman, from what we gather, but he claims he saw the man jump in from off that rock pile, and then he found the woman in the truck dead."
He spat.
"A hell of a mix-up, ain't it?"
One of the motors suddenly cut. We all looked up. The man in back of one of the boats stood up, began pulling heavily on his rope.
"Let's hope they got him," the deputy said. "I'd like to get home."
In a minute or two, I saw an arm emerge out of the water. The hooks had evidently struck him in the side or the back. The arm submerged a minute later and then reappeared along with a shapeless bundle of something. "It's not him," I thought for an instant. "It's something else that has been in the pond for months." The men in the front of the boat moved to the back, and together they hauled the dripping bundle over the side. I looked at Father, who'd turned away, lips trembling. His face was lined, set. He looked older, suddenly, and terrified. He turned to me and said,
"Women. That's what the wrong kind of woman can do for you, Jack."
But he stammered when he said it and moved his feet uncomfortably, and I don't think he really believed it. He just didn't know what else to say at the time. I'm not sure what he believed. I only know he was frightened with the sight as I was. But it seemed to me life was more difficult for him after that, that he was never able to act happy and carefree anymore. Not like he used to act, anyway. For myself, I knew I wouldn't forget the sight of that arm emerging out of the water. Like some kind of mysterious and terrible signal, it seemed to herald the misfortune that dogged our family in the coming years. But that was an impressionable period, from 12 to 20. Now that I'm older, as old as my father was then, have lived a while in the world, been around some, as they say, I know it now for what it was, that arm. Simply, the arm of a drowned man. I have seen others. "Let's go home," my father said.
Pie. Her car was there, no others, and Bert gave thanks for that. He pulled into the drive and stopped beside the pie he'd dropped last night. It was still there, the aluminum pan upside down, the pumpkin splattered on the pavement. It was Friday, almost noon, the day after Christmas. He'd come on Christmas Day to visit his wife and children. But Vera told him before he came that he had to be gone before 6 o'clock when her friend and his children were coming for dinner. They had sat in the living room and solemnly opened the presents he had brought. The lights on the Christmas tree blinked. Packages wrapped in shiny paper and secured with ribbons and bows lay stuffed under the tree, waiting for 6 o'clock. He watched the children, Terry and Jack, open their gifts. He waited while Vera's fingers carefully undid the ribbon and tape on her present. She unwrapped the paper. She opened the box and took out a beige cashmere sweater.
"It's nice," she said.
"Thank you, Bert."
"Try it on," Terry said to her mother.
"Put it on, Mom," Jack said. "All right, Dad."
Bert looked at his son, grateful for this show of support. He could ask Jack to ride his bicycle over some morning during these holidays, and they'd go out for breakfast. She did try it on. She went into the bathroom and came out, running her hands up and down the front of the sweater.
"It's nice," she said.
"It looks great on you," Bert said and felt a welling in his chest.
He opened his gifts. From Vera, a certificate for $20 at Sondheim's men's store, a matching comb and brush set from Terry, handkerchiefs, 3 pair of socks, and a ballpoint pen from Jack. He and Vera drank rum and coke. It grew dark outside and became 5:30. Terry looked at her mother and got up and began to set the dining room table. Jack went to his room. Bert liked it where he was, in front of the fireplace, a glass in his hand, the smell of turkey in the air. Vera went into the kitchen. Bert leaned back on the sofa. Christmas carols came to him from the radio in Vera's bedroom. From time to time, Terry walked into the dining room with something for the table. Bert watched as she placed linen napkins in the wine glasses. A slender vase with a single red rose appeared. Then Vera and Terry began talking in low voices in the kitchen. He finished his drink. A little wax and sawdust log burned on the grate, giving off red, blue, and green flames. He got up from the sofa and put 8 logs, the entire carton, into the fireplace. He watched until they began to flame. Then, making for the patio door, he caught sight of the pies lined up on the sideboard. He stacked them up in his arms. There were 5 of them, pumpkin and mincemeat. She must think she was feeding a soccer team. He got out of the house with the pies, but in the drive in the dark, he dropped a pie as he fumbled with the car door. Now he walked around the broken pie and headed for the patio door. The front door was permanently closed since that night his key had broken off inside the lock. It was an overcast day, the air damp and sharp. Vera was saying he'd tried to burn the house down last night. That's what she'd told the children, what Terry had repeated to him when he called the house this morning to apologize.
"Mom said you tried to burn the house down last night," Terry had said and laughed.
He wanted to set the record straight. He also wanted to talk about things in general. There was a wreath made out of pine cones on the patio door. He rapped on the glass. Vera looked out at him and frowned. She was in her bathrobe. She opened the door a little.
"Vera, I want to apologize for last night," he said. "I'm sorry I did what I did. It was stupid. I want to apologize to the kids, too."
"They're not here," she said. "Terry is off with her boyfriend, that son of a bitch, and his motorcycle, and Jack is playing football." She stood in the doorway, and he stood on the patio next to the philodendron plant. He pulled at some lint on his coat sleeve.
"I can't take any more scenes after last night," she said. "I've had it, Bert. You literally tried to burn the house down last night."
"I did not."
"You did. Everybody here was a witness. You ought to see the fireplace. You almost caught the wall on fire."
"Can I come in for a minute and talk about it?" he said. "Vera?"
She looked at him. She pulled the robe together at her throat and moved back inside.
"Come in," she said. "But I have to go somewhere in an hour. And please try to restrain yourself. Don't pull anything again, Bert. Don't, for God's sake, try to burn my house down again."
"Vera, for heaven's sake, it's true."
He didn't answer. He looked around. The Christmas tree lights blinked off and on. There was a pile of soft tissue papers and empty boxes at the end of the sofa. A turkey carcass filled a platter in the center of the dining room table. The bones were picked clean, and the leathery remains sat upright in a bed of parsley,
as if in a kind of horrible nest. The napkins were soiled and had been dropped here and there on the table. Some of the dishes were stacked, and the cups and wine glasses had been moved to one end of the table, as if someone had started to clean up but thought better of it. It was true the fireplace had black smoke stains reaching up the bricks toward the mantel. A mound of ash filled the fireplace, along with an empty Shasta cola can.
"Come out to the kitchen," Vera said. "I'll make some coffee, but I have to leave pretty soon."
"What time did your friend leave last night?"
"If you're going to start that, you can go right now."
"Okay, okay."
He pulled a chair out and sat down at the kitchen table in front of the big ashtray. He closed his eyes and opened them. He moved the curtain aside and looked out at the backyard. A bicycle without a front wheel rested on its handlebars and seat. Weeds grew along the redwood fence.
"Thanksgiving?" she said. She ran water into a saucepan. "Do you remember Thanksgiving? I said then that was the last holiday you'd ever ruin for us. Eating bacon and eggs instead of turkey at 10 o'clock at night. People can't live like that, Bert."
"I know it. I said I'm sorry, Vera. I meant it."
"Sorry isn't good enough anymore. It just isn't."
The pilot light was out again. She was at the stove trying to light the gas burner under the pan of water. "Don't burn yourself," he said. "Don't catch yourself on fire." She didn't answer. She lit the ring.
He could imagine her robe catching fire and himself jumping up from the table, throwing her down onto the floor and rolling her over and over into the living room where he would cover her with his own body. Or should he run into the bedroom first for a blanket to throw over her?
"Vera?" She looked at him. "Do you have anything to drink around the house? Any of that rum left? I could use a drink this morning. Take the chill off."
"There's some vodka in the freezer, and there is rum around here somewhere if the kids didn't drink it up."
"When did you start keeping vodka in the freezer?"
"Don't ask."
"Okay, I won't."
He took the vodka from the freezer, looked for a glass, then poured some into a cup he found on the counter.
"Are you going to just drink it like that out of a cup? Jesus, Bert. What do you want to talk about anyway? I told you I have some place to go. I have a flute lesson at 1 o'clock. What is it you want, Bert?"
"Are you still taking flute?"
"I just said so. What is it? Tell me what's on your mind, and then I have to get ready."
"I just wanted to say I was sorry about last night, for one thing. I was upset. I'm sorry."
"You're always upset at something. You were just drunk and wanted to take it out on us."
"That's not true."
"Why'd you come over here then, when you knew we had plans? You could have come the night before. I told you about the dinner I planned yesterday."
"It was Christmas. I wanted to drop off my gifts. You're still my family."
She didn't answer.
"I think you're right about this vodka," he said. "If you have any juice, I'll mix this with some juice."
She opened the refrigerator and moved things around.
"There's cran apple juice, that's all."
"That's fine," he said.
He got up and poured cran apple juice into his cup, added more vodka, and stirred the drink with his little finger.
"I have to go to the bathroom," she said. "Just a minute."
He drank the cup of cran apple juice and vodka and felt better. He lit a cigarette and tossed the match into the big ashtray. The bottom of the ashtray was covered with cigarette stubs and a layer of ash. He recognized Vera's brand, but there were some unfiltered cigarettes as well, and another brand, lavender-colored stubs heavy with lipstick. He got up and dumped the mess into the sack under the sink. The ashtray was a heavy piece of blue stoneware with raised edges they'd bought from a bearded potter on the mall in Santa Cruz. It was as big as a plate, and maybe that's what it had been intended for, a plate or a serving dish of some sort, but they'd immediately started using it as an ashtray. He put it back on the table and ground out his cigarette in it. The water on the stove began to bubble just as the phone rang. She opened the bathroom door and called to him through the living room.
"Answer that, will you? I'm just about to get into the shower."
The kitchen phone was on the counter in a corner behind the roasting pan. It kept ringing. He picked up the receiver cautiously.
Is Charlie there? A flat, toneless voice asked him.
No,
he said. You must have the wrong number. This is 323-4464. You have the wrong number. Okay, the voice said. But while he was seeing to the coffee, the phone rang again. He answered.
Charlie, you have the wrong number. Look here, you'd better check your numbers again. Look at your prefix.
This time he left the receiver off the hook. Vera came back into the kitchen wearing jeans and a white sweater and brushing her hair. He added instant coffee to the cups of hot water, stirred the coffee, and then floated vodka onto his coffee. He carried the cups over to the table. She picked up the receiver, listened, and said,
What's this about? Who was on the phone?
Nobody, he said. It was a wrong number. Who smokes lavender-colored cigarettes?
Terry. Who else would smoke such things?
I didn't know she was smoking these days, he said. I haven't seen her smoking.
Well, she is. I guess she doesn't want to do it in front of you yet, she said. That's a laugh if you think about it.
She put down the hairbrush.
But that son of a bitch she's going out with, that's something else. He's trouble. He's been in and out of scrapes ever since he dropped out of high school.
Tell me about it.
I just did. He's a creep. I worry about it, but I don't know what I can do. My God, Bert, I've got my hands full. It makes you wonder sometimes.
She sat across the table from him and drank her coffee. They smoked and used the ashtray. There were things he wanted to say, words of devotion and regret, consoling things.
Terry also steals my dope and smokes that too, Vera said. If you really want to know what goes on around here.
God almighty, she smokes dope? Vera nodded. I didn't come over here to hear that.
What did you come over here for then? You didn't get all the pie last night?
He recalled stacking pie on the floorboards of the car before driving away last night. Then he'd forgotten all about pie. The pies were still in the car. For a minute, he thought he should tell her.
Vera, he said, it's Christmas. That's why I came.